Welcome to FMI's Built-In Podcast. I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. Retired Air Force Colonel Chris Strickland is the founding president of Dunn University, a business executive and three-time best-selling leadership author, as well as a highly sought-after motivational keynote speaker. In his role as president of Dunn University, he has the responsibility to recruit, train, develop, and retain the best workforce possible for Dunn, the construction industry, and for Alabama. As part of this effort, he partnered with the Alabama Community College System to pioneer revolutionary methods of training Alabamians in new careers with livable wages and career progression pathways. As a result of his workforce efforts, Chris has been appointed by Alabama Governor Kay Ivey to the Alabama Workforce Board and testified before Congress in 2024 on these same initiatives. He is a combat-proven senior military leader, and after 23 years of service in the Air Force, Chris retired from active duty following a final role where he led a 7,000-person, $7 billion-a-year global organization. His style combines his unique experience as a U.S. Air Force Thunderbird solo pilot, coupled with CEO-level duties and Pentagon-level strategic management of critical Air Force resources valued at $840 billion, multiple NATO assignments, White House and DARPA fellowships, and command experience in the United States Air Force to uniquely lead Dunn University into their next century of construction excellence. Well, Chris, first of all, let me welcome you to the show and say thank you for being here. And most of all, thank you for your service.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. I always love a chat with you.
Well, just to kind of get us grounded and kick off, if you wouldn't mind, maybe share a little bit of background on just the Dunn Companies today.
The Dunn Companies today, that's an interesting question. It's a very large company that covers multiple states and multiple industries. But the best way to explain it to you is it's a family-run business. It's family-run, family-owned. We're on fifth generation right now. And regardless of how big it gets, it feels like a family every day we come to work. Everybody cares about what we do. Everybody cares about the difference we make in our economy and to the local communities. And more importantly, they care about each other. And that's something to say in today's world of multiple employees and multiple locations. But that's the best way to explain it. Not only do they care about what they do in their locations, they care about the industry. So Dunn Companies cares about the communities we're in and making the industries better even outside of our companies, which is kind of what brought us here today to talk.
I love the way you frame that. And certainly fifth generation, privately held and still family held and run. That's rarefied air.
The reason I joined the company 6 years ago was because I found out they have multiple employees that have 55 years of service. We have one sitting right down the hall from me. And we also have three generation families working here. And nothing says more about the culture in a company than a father wanting their son and their grandson or granddaughter to work for the company. So that's really the best summary you can give for Dunn Companies.
Truly, truly amazing. Well, maybe take that same question, if you would, and give an update on just Dunn University as it stands today.
Dunn University is an amazing organization that I have the honor of leading here. And it's really my passion because it's really to recruit, train, develop, and retain. That's our four pillars that we're put underneath, but it's so much more than that. Like I said, our CEO pushes me to go out and make the industry better. So I spend a lot of my time with industry partners and volunteer work, working at the governor's office on the workforce council and things like that. But the most exciting part of Dunn University for me is not the hard skills which are required in construction. It's the soft skills that I get the chance to take out to our team and develop in them. And that's something that my dad was in construction when I grew up here in Alabama, and I didn't see back then. They only cared about what his hands could do. And now we're putting people into leadership roles in construction. And more often than not, if you can run a piece of equipment, we put you into a leadership role without any training. And that's not an indictment. It's just a reality of what we do. And people want to succeed and they want training to make them better. And that's what Dunn University offers is a leadership 101 class, is how to deal with people class, how to lead people. And the first class I taught, the feedback I had from an individual who had been with us in excess of three decades was, you've always cared about my hands. Now you care about my heart and my head. And people work so much harder when you invest in them and you invest in their growth, both intrinsic of what they can do as well as what they can do with their hands. And that's what Dunn University is in a big nutshell. It's investing in people to make them the best they can be.
There's a saying, I can't remember where I read it. Treat the soft stuff as the hard stuff.
That's it.
This is exactly that is like it. You're talking about. It says easy, does hard, but there's a lot to unpack on that front. So In our prep call, I was fascinated by the origin story of how this all came about. So maybe if you could take us back a few years to how this came to be and how you came to be sitting here as president of Dunn University.
I love the origin story. I love the chance to tell it. So after retiring from the military, 23 years and 3 months, us military people are terrified to get out into the real civilian world because my adult life, I only knew the military. And so I came out and I did what was easy. I went to a military organization of fighter pilots, Navy SEALs, and Army Rangers, consultant leadership with mainly Fortune 100 companies. And I loved it. I loved the people I got to hang out with. What I didn't love was flying 160 times a year. It was brutal. I was never home. It wasn't what I retired for. So my wife and I made the decision that I was going to turn in my notice and find something else to do. And in October of 2018, I was literally on my 155th flight of the year. And I got on the plane and somebody was sitting in my seat. And for a frequent traveler, don't make me take my AirPods out. This is a day of work going to Palo Alto. I don't want to have to talk to people. I don't want to sound bad, but it's true. So I had to take my AirPods out and start talking to this guy. And he had all these books and all these papers. And even though I had turned in my notice, I'm still the consultant. So I start pitching a contract because that's what consultants do. And at the end of the flight, it was a short flight to connect with a longer one. He pulls out a white binder and it says Dunn University on it. He goes, everything you just told me, we're building in the company. And he turned out to be one of the owners of Dunn, one of the family that owns Dunn. And he said, we're building that organization and we're looking for somebody to lead it. And you just told me everything you do, which is what we're looking for in that leader. And I said, well, I said, you can hire me as a consultant and I'll charge you a little bit too much, or you can just bring me on full time and I'll run it for you. And that way I get to see the fruits of our labor. I get to own the success of the organization. And 3 months later, they gave me a call and an interview, and that's how Dunn University got started.
Maybe just to continue on that thread a little bit, if you would, talk about your original mandate. So you get the job, you get the gig, and you're day one. What was your charge?
Day one, I come in, and at the president level, we all work for boards. So I have the board that's a CEO and a couple of our senior executives on there, and we sit down and we talk what Dunn University is going to become. And I always joke about it this way. The CEO looks at me and he hands me an office, a whiteboard, a computer, and a checkbook and says, go do it. And I said, Will, go do what? And he goes, it, go do it. We don't know what we're going to do yet, but we're going to do it and we're going to be great at it. So go do it. And I joke about that, but that's an incredibly challenging charter. When you don't have a defined, we don't know, that's the definition of innovation. In my military career, I had the opportunity to work for DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. And it's an amazing organization where their mantra is they take advancements 20 years away and make them happen in the next three. And it was the same kind of problem there of you're staring at a whiteboard going, I have to fix a problem, but first I have to define the problem to fix and then determine how to fix it. And so my first briefing to him, the first slide, which he still don't like to this day, I joke about it all the time, was that my goal at Dunn University was to fail fast. And what I meant was, we are going to try a lot of things that we're going to innovate, and not all of them are going to work. We have to admit that up front. With innovation, not everything works, but it's okay. We're not going to put too many eggs in that basket. We're going to know when it's not working. We're going to learn from that path and redirect to something else that does. And that's how you become successful in innovation, is that fail fast mantra. And from there, that's where we developed our leadership classes. That's where we developed our outreach classes that we do. And we started partnering with other people down the road to get some skills that I don't have, right? You got to know what you're good at. You also know what other people are good at, and you need to complement each other. Don't try to do everything yourself. So I'm sure we'll talk about it, but we partnered with some other agencies to make this even stronger.
You talk about fail fast. I know Charlie Munger talks a lot, or used to talk a lot before he passed, about just inversion and how powerful it is. You know, inversion is nothing more than just thinking about failure and then engineering its removal. So all the things that would cause it to fail, go ahead and just don't do those things. You know, like Bill Belichick would talk about, more games are lost than won in the NFL. Turnovers, mistakes, mental mistakes. And so let's just build the team, build the organization, build a mindset so that we don't, in those moments, crumble. So as you're going through it and placing small bets, failing fast, you learn and you just know, okay, let's file that in the pile of let's not do that anymore.
That's right. You got to have lessons learned. We have to do that in business. Yeah. We have to do it in life. You have to learn from the lessons. Otherwise, they're a lesson experience that you're going to relearn down the road. So we did that debrief with everything we did, whether it was successful or not, right? Because most people debrief things when they don't go well. Postmortem, there's a million words for it. but they always want to do it when something doesn't achieve what they wanted. But more important to that is when you debrief wins, because you debrief losses because you want to make sure it doesn't happen again. And you want to understand why, but you debrief wins because you want to be able to sustain that, not just be lucky one time.
Exactly. Exactly. So you touched on this and I want to come back to it because I think it's pretty powerful. So starting with a blank checkbook sounds great, but most things or many things succeed because they have to operate within constraints and it forces creativity and innovation. So how did you operate in sort of this landscape of having no constraints and basically just blank canvas?
Well, let me reframe that just a little bit. It wasn't no constraints. It was a blank checkbook. It wasn't an endless checkbook. Right? Those are two different things. And we just didn't know how to put a budget against it in the beginning because we didn't know what we were going to do. You can't budget for something you don't know what you need for the pieces or the people. So what that meant was it was an awesome opportunity with the senior leaders of this company. And we have 10 different operating companies, all of which operate with different presidents, local construction done by local people. So it's a big peer network in our company underneath the CEO, but it caused incredible teamwork because we had to over talk about everything we're going to do because it wasn't budgeted. I had to go back to him to get money for things to do. I had to coordinate with the other leaders to talk to their teams as we move forward. And it was a level of communication I don't think had been experienced before. And that was the beauty of it, because we made time to get together and talk about what difference we wanted to make, what we wanted to change, and what we wanted to be down the road. So one of the first things we looked at, this was, you know, I came on board when hiring was hard and we couldn't fill seats everywhere. And our goal was not to recruit better. Our goal was to ensure everybody knew what an awesome company it was, what an awesome culture it was, so that people are lined up to get in the door, right? They're looking for us instead of us going to look for them. So it was both internal to build our people and also external to spread the word of our company and build our credibility out in the industry.
Chris, building on what you said about creating the right environment and an exciting environment that people really want to plug into, what would you point to as the tipping points that really caused that flywheel to get moving?
I think it's not really one thing. It's a complement of multiple things. First of all, it's our people. Most of our recruits come from word of mouth, people saying how much they enjoy working here. But it was also building credibility in the industry. Not that we didn't have it, right? We're 145 years old. We had credibility, but it's being more vocal about the credibility and some of the partnerships we had as we reached out, doing things like this, right? Why would a construction company ever do a podcast? Now, 6 years later, here you and I are having a podcast talking about this. But that's a different mindset moving forward. And one of my initial charters, as we're stumbling around trying to figure out what we do, the CEO told me he wanted me to teach people to run a backhoe because we have a lot of backhoes on our job sites. Well, I'm a fighter pilot, right? I don't know how to run a backhoe. Now, deep down, I'm a 10-year-old kid that will run every piece of equipment out there, but that don't mean I can teach somebody. So I went to the manufacturers and I looked at their training, and it gets into a scale issue. How do I scale training to make sure we train people with a quality training and a certification? So as you start peeling back this onion, there is no certification to run a backhoe. There is no official recognized certification anywhere. You teach them to run them at your company. I teach them to run at my company. And my example was, when I'm qualified to fly an F-15 in Florida, I'm qualified to fly it around the world, in Iraq, in New York, anywhere else. There's one certification. And we didn't have that. So we sat down with some industry partners. I always joke that this happened at a government meeting down in our capital. We were having a meeting to have a meeting to develop a plan to not do anything for 5 years. You know, we've all been a part of those. Right. And we had a couple of military people there, and we don't tend to do well in those things. So we were griping about it at a coffee pot. And so a couple of us said, well, we're going to go make a difference. And so we started meeting every month in a central location and locking ourselves in a room for 3 hours with a whiteboard and trying to figure out what problem we were going to solve. And the problem was, working adults don't have time to go get certified in things to better themselves a lot of the time. So we need to go to where they are, hit them the way they want to be hit, how they can study, how they want to be study, and so they can learn in a manner to improve themselves. So we picked the skid steer first, and the Alabama Community College became a part of this. The chancellor was very supportive. The governor was very supportive. And our goal was, right, because you got to define the measure of success down the road. And instead of training somebody to be the best skid steer operator in the world, our goal was to train the first 2 weeks. That's what industry said, train the first 2 weeks. What does that mean? They're not great at running the skid steer. They're safe at running the skid steer. They can check the oil. They know how to put on the PPE, the personal protective equipment. They know how to operate on job sites. They know the basic operation of a skid steer. And when they walk in, they're on the first day of week three, and now I can teach them how to run it my way. And so we went after a grant. We got the grant to teach it through one of our community colleges. I love a pilot test, right? You got to validate a concept before you go all in. And it was a hit. I mean, everybody loved it. Community college said, why is a community college teaching a hard skill, right? When the president said, when I sign this certificate, how do I know you're going to honor it? Well, the answer was industry made the input for the syllabus. Industry gave the instructor that was certified by the college. So of course, we're going to honor his certificate. And it grew into something that just grew out of control. I mean, it's still growing to this day. As of today, 3 years later, we have trained 5,000 people in certified skills and have over 30,000 people enrolled in the community college system in Alabama. It's a non-credit generating, it's a certificate generating, and on average, when somebody gets a certificate, so let me take you back to the class. It's about 35 hours of theory online, on demand, on any device you want that you take on your time once you're enrolled in the class. Once you graduate from theory, you schedule yourself for one of the lab portions. So again, sticking with the skid steer, that's a two-day in-seat class taught at one of 23 community colleges across the state of Alabama. You go to wherever's convenient for you for a two-day class and you get certified in the operation. When you graduate from that class, on average, that person makes $5 more per hour starting wage than a person that gets hired without that certification. That's a measure of success for our people. And the overall goal is to give them a job with a career progression pathway with a livable wage for their family. So they're not working multiple jobs. So they have a way to grow in money as they go down the road and grow in skills. So I'm really proud of the community college system and how they're running with that as we're moving forward.
I mean, that is a heck of an elevator pitch, right? It's hard to beat that when you've got that level of tangible success where people feel it in their pocketbook. There's several things you mentioned that I want to come back to, but before I forget, going back to the conversation around constraints, I'm curious what you started with in the way of resources alongside you to help get this started.
The biggest resource I had was everybody was motivated to do it. We just didn't know what we were doing. And you know what I'm talking about, that everybody's happy, everybody's excited, everybody's willing to put in the time, then we just have to frame what it is. And that was a big thing because to begin with, this wasn't an expensive thing to start other than me and my office. To begin with, it was just me before I started hiring some staff on here. And we would go out, I would go out and work on job sites, see what they needed. And we would develop classes around that. And the cost to the operating company was the time of their crews that they put in. And the cost to our CEO was my salary and my travel as we grew this. And I will tell you, in the first 2 years, because it wasn't just innovation, it was also where we could be more efficient. Innovation and efficiency go together. So for the first 2 years, we tracked both the cost avoidance of initiatives we had and also the reduced cost of things we had. And we paid for Dunn University tenfold for those first 2 years. And we just stopped tracking it because we were getting more efficiency and cost avoidance than we were spending in things on Dunn University. And that just validated it was worth our effort and investment from the CEO. And so once that happened, then we started expanding and I just sit down with my board and the CEO and I tell them where I want to take it every board meeting and they approve it or they readjust for what they want. And then we go out and do it. It is very agile organization. To be innovative, you have to be very agile, which is why I have to work for the senior leaders, right? It wouldn't work if I was mid-level in the company and had to go to 10 people for permission. But that was the beauty of how they designed this thing. It had nothing to do with me. It had to do with their vision as they wanted to improve their construction company.
So kind of building on that, how do you strike the right balance between the hard skills and the soft skills?
Well, really, when you look at it, the technical stuff is at the beginning of your career. That's where you're getting established. You think about our careers. I always say it's the first 10 years of a career are the hardest because you're establishing your credibility, you're establishing your technical knowledge and your technical skills. And really, the soft skills start kicking in once you go toward that first level supervisor. That's where we really need the soft skills, which means we don't do it when they get promoted. We need to do it just before they get promoted. So they're ready to take that seat and lead a team. Because we all know most people leave their job, not because they're unhappy with their job, but because they're unhappy with their first level supervisor that deals with their life every day. So that's really our balance is those initial skills are targeted at the younger, and I don't mean age, I mean experience-wise people. And then the soft skills start coming in at first level supervisor all the way up through our vice presidents as we're building different levels of that soft skill development. And it's everything from leadership 101 in the first class, effective communication, which is my creative way of hiding public speaking because people tend to be scared of public speaking. And it just goes on and above. We have a class on having the difficult conversations with people because usually when a leader has to let somebody go, has to help them find another job that's not on our team, nobody's told them how to do that. And that's a life-changing event for both the person it happens to and the person giving it. If the person giving it don't take it harsh, they probably shouldn't be in a leadership role because that's changing somebody's life. So we have all those little, what I call micro learning sessions that we can do based on the level of leadership that the group we're in front of needs.
I'd love for you to tell me how you ended up testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee on the path to Alabama becoming number one in the nation for workforce innovation.
I'm still pretty curious about that myself. It was a weird call to get in. So back to what's the tipping point of an organization with both credibility and culture to get the recognition that we have enjoyed recently? As part of my efforts out working with the community college and everybody else, the governor asked me to be on her workforce council. And it goes across Alabama with leaders as we're trying to improve Alabama's workforce. And she has a mandate to increase it by a certain amount in 5 years. And we're really on the track to do that. But as part of being in that organization, her office gets a call from DC that, hey, we heard you guys are doing good things down in Alabama. We need somebody to come up and testify to the Ways and Means Committee on that. And then very shortly after that, I get a call from her staff that says, hey, do we have a deal for you? And I accepted because who doesn't want to testify in Congress, right? And I will tell you, there were some prep calls in there as I went up there, obviously talking to my CEO to make sure that's something we wanted to do, talking to her staff to get ready. Because in that role, you're really speaking for the state, right? You're representative of the state, and you got to make sure every word aligns with what her goal is, as long as with the industry and everything else. So I was privileged to get to do that. And we speak a lot like I am with you here today. But when you go up and sit in front of a committee and you swear in on your testimony and it has to be written and it has to be documented and the writing of your talk has to be published, that's a different level of speaking. But I will tell you, it's one of the most amazing things I've ever had the opportunity to do because the committee sitting in front of me just ate it up. They loved it. There was so much talk after because the whole talk was really about, the way I explain it is at the time we were trying to put hammers in hands, right? That's how you get people working, put hammers in hands. And I don't think that's the right answer. I think that's a weak answer. And I don't think that generates careers, that generates jobs. Instead, you have to find out what inspires people, what their intrinsic goals are, what their satisfaction is. And it will come with a hammer in hand. But if they're not inspired to do that every day, it's not a career for them. A career is something that you enjoy going to. I love going home to my family on Friday. I'm just as excited to come to work on Monday because I love what I get to do. Everybody has that in them if somebody spends the time to discover what it is. So my testimony, which you can still go watch up there, was less about putting hammers in hands and more about finding the motivation of how do we get the people back in the workforce who are choosing not to contribute right now, who are choosing not to participate. We have horrible job force participation rates right now. And the way we do that is not by giving them a minimum wage job. It's finding something they can grow in for the rest of their life. And that is what the message to the House of Representatives was.
Pretty powerful. It's hearts and minds, right?
Hearts and minds.
How do you make that connection at a visceral level to get people that excited and that engaged? Well, let me shift. And you've talked about this and you talked about scale earlier, but how do you go about scaling leadership across the enterprise when you can't be everywhere all at once?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing. And it's something like you and I have talked about recently. It's the hardest thing for me because right now I'm the only instructor. And I have one 2-year class I take people through. It's a leadership class that is really in depth for our up and coming senior leaders. And we meet once a quarter for 2 years at a different operating company. And we talk about a different topic of leadership, kind of like your team does with people around the world. And what we're doing right now, as I'm challenged to scale this year away from just being me, is the group I have right now, we talked about it yesterday, we're going to build inclusive classes that they can go out and teach. So we have a student guide that you'll print out for the students, and we have a leadership guide that the facilitator, less of a teacher in that role, more of a facilitator. So you have a facilitation guide along with slides or videos or whatever content they need so that now they can take it out to their teams and have a lunch and learn to begin with. That's where we're going to start. Then they can start teaching classes. As we build classes at Dunn University, that way you can go out to your team and go, hey, we're going to get lunch today and we're going to talk about this topic of leadership. And you're confident enough that that leadership guide, that facilitation guide, takes you through how to lead it so that they can get something from it. So that's really our next step of doing that. And it goes back to the consulting model, right? In my consulting company that I came from, we had 1099s. And when we surged, we would bring more 1099s on to facilitate, and they would get a facilitation guide so that they could do the same thing we do, just at a lesser level. And that's the way we scaled our team there, as opposed to having a 100-person team on staff that you only need once a month. And so we're kind of using that model here, combined with, like you said, the military model of hearts and minds. That's what wins everybody. And that's the way we're going to scale down the road, in addition to using other things. So when I teach class, it's not just me. I bring in one of your experts to teach us finances. He comes in every class, he teaches finances, and then we put one of our CFOs up there to translate that to our operating statements. And that is finding the people that are the best at what they do and not trying to be the best at everything you do. And so we complement it with outside speakers, outside engagements, but that's the way we're going to scale on our team. And when you facilitate, you've probably heard this before. When you take a class, you learn something. When you teach a class, you have to know more than you've ever known before. So that's going to twofold, not only spread the word to our people and build leadership, it's also going to build our senior leaders even more when they're facilitating the classes.
That's what makes it sticky, right? You know, the fact that you've got to take the time, invest the time to really know your stuff, because you're going to be put somewhat in front of the firing squad, so to speak, and be forced to answer a lot of questions that maybe you hadn't anticipated.
That's right. That when we taught people to fly the F-15 at schoolhouse, we taught instructors first. And we told them, you have to know the jet through and through, because they're going to ask you what you think is stupid questions, but they're not stupid questions. If you can't answer them, it's your fault. You have to be able to answer all of them for your credibility. And when somebody doesn't know anything, they're going to ask what experienced people think are real ridiculous questions that need to be answered.
Well, Chris, you've unpacked a tremendous amount of information, and it's such a fascinating story and so inspiring. I'm curious if you kind of go back over the arc of your career, from military to private sector, what's the single greatest piece of leadership advice that you've ever received?
That's a tough one. I would tell you, it's going to be kind of counterintuitive. So after I was a Thunderbird, I worked at the Pentagon. I always say I was the lowest ranking person. I was a captain, which is basically, I don't even get to make the coffee at the Pentagon with all the generals up there. And we were working a project. My boss was a 2-star general, and she was amazing. And we were working something that we had to give to Congress at the time. And we were just at a blank wall. I mean, we were beating our head against the wall. We couldn't come up with the answer. And we were on a time crunch. And she grabbed her gym bag, and we both ran at the time. And she goes, let's go to the gym and go running. And I said, ma'am, I can't. I said, I'll keep working while you're running. And she goes, oh, you misunderstood me, Captain. Right? I'm leaving. Therefore, you're leaving. And we're going running. And so we left. It tormented me because I couldn't spare the time. And we went running. And it's a beautiful place to run when you live in DC. Obviously, there's so much to see out there. And so when we got back to the run, we both hit the showers in our own locker rooms and came back to our office. And she sat down. She goes, okay, what's the answer? And immediately we came up with the answer. And she goes, now, what did you learn today? She said, if bullets aren't flying and people aren't dying, you have time to make a decision. And sometimes the best thing you can do is step away from it, because you get too emotionally close to it, too emotionally charged, too frustrated. And she said, if we hadn't went for a run, we never would have came up with this answer, because you came up with the answer on mile 3 after you had relaxed, got into your groove, listening to music. And she goes, remember that when you're in command, always take time to step away so you can see the big picture. And I think that's true in life, in our relationships, in everything we do. Nothing really is life or death. It really is not. We have time to catch a breath and relax and settle down as we're trying to lead other people.
Probably do a whole nother episode on flow states and getting, you know,
that's right,
you know, seeing the forest for the trees and being able to elevate every so often just to look at the playing field, as opposed to like being in the thick of the playing field. Building on that, Chris, I'm curious, are there any parting thoughts that we haven't covered already that you think our audience would really get a lot out of?
So on that, I would say we all have the passion in us. You need to find a group of people who are like-minded and just as passionate that want to make a difference. And when you get that group together and nobody's in it for anything, right? We're here talking. I don't need anything from you, Scott. You don't need anything from me. We're just having a good conversation. That's the kind of peer relationships you need to just open conversations, find out where you can improve things, and make one small step. It all starts with that first step, right? We never would have thought we are where we are today when we first started out. We never could have envisioned it being that big and getting ready to go nationwide, which is back to the reason we testified up there is they want to roll this model out beyond Alabama to other states. We have 19 other states talking to the community colleges right now about licensing that model in other states. But when you find that group of people that charge you up, when you leave, you're not drained. When you leave, I call it a plus one, right? There's a book out there, is a relationship a plus one, a zero, or a minus one? You need to find your plus one people, spend time with them so that you can feed off of each other's motivation and go make a difference in whatever you have purview over. If we all make a difference, then the change is going to be great.
Reminded of I think it was Bill Gates who made a comment like, big starts out small. Take the first step. Most people overestimate what they can achieve in a year and dramatically underestimate what they can achieve in 10 years, but you got to start. So it goes back to like fail fast, take steps, lots of steps. And at some point the flywheel will start to catch on.
That's it. But you can't be afraid to get started. We can all make a difference.
Well, Chris, this was amazing. I can't thank you enough for one, taking the time to do this, for sharing your story of inspiration with our audience. And lastly, again, just thank you for your service.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate what you do, taking your company out and helping us with peer groups and everything else you guys do. So always glad to be connected with you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Built In. And please remember to like or subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode.